The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 331, a panel discussion entitled, What Does It Mean to Me to Call Joseph Smith a Prophet? With panelists H. Parker Blunt, Lisa Tensmeyer Hansen, Ricardo Diaz, Christopher K. Bigelow, Paul Montclair, and Mary Beth Raines.
It's time for this session to begin, so... Those of you that are participating, if you would join us. This is session 331. What does it mean to me to call Joseph Smith a prophet? I'm Parker Blunt, and I'm going to just make a word or two about this panel in the interest of time. I want us to move right along. I'm not going to do lengthy introductions of the participants because there's a brief blurb, and many of them have been around Sunstone, and you know them already. If you haven't read the abstract, please read the abstract, because this grows out of my continually badgering Dan. He denies that, but that's really the truth. To let's have a session where people who are active in the church, and I'm the token inactive, deal with all the different versions and the different information that's come out about Joseph Smith over the last years. We have not colluded in any way, so it would be really quite interesting to me to hear the different presentations and how people are responding to Joseph Smith. Now, so with that brief introduction, and what I will do is ask each of the participants to please follow the order that you're presented in the program. So with that, I'm going to begin with my paper, which I entitle Thoughts About Joseph, a Patchwork Quilt. My grandmother was a quilter. From scraps of material left over from other sewing projects, she cut small squares and triangles. Later, she sewed the squares and triangles into small blocks. These blocks were sewn together to make larger blocks. This continued until she had a quilt top. Her quilting held little interest for me, a boy, not yet in my teens, but I remember it as a backdrop on the stage of another set of memories. Mattie Parker lived with us for a period of time when we lived in Brunswick, Georgia, hard against the marshes of Glen, which the poet Sidney Lanier wrote. On long summer days, I would sometimes wander into her bedroom where I would find her busy quilting. She would use those visits to round out my religious education, since at the time there was not a branch of the church in the area. As grandmother cut, stitched, and made piles of squares, she introduced me to Joseph Smith. She told me about the boy, only a few years older than I was at the time, who didn't know which church to join. I learned about his reading the verse in James and desperately needing wisdom. He made his way into a grove of trees, there encountering God and being commissioned to restore the true church. I was fascinated, as she told me, of angelic visions to Joseph, gold plates, Moroni, and Nephi. She told me of Joseph's courage as he underwent surgery on his leg while a boy, refusing even to drink alcohol to deaden the pain. He withstood tarring and feathering and could out-wrestle anyone. He founded a city that became one of the largest and politically powerful in the state. He was a lieutenant general, yet he was meek and humble and courageous to the last, going to his death like a lamb. She told me these stories with such conviction that, as far as I knew, she had witnessed them herself. They were as much a part of her life as were her accounts of being a young wife and mother in a sawmill camp in North Florida. I had no reason to doubt anything she told me. The Joseph I believed in and the way I viewed him were based not only on the stories she told, but the conviction with which she told them and her obvious love for the prophet. As a result, I carried around a vision of this clear-eyed boy who taught with God and angels. He was persecuted, wounded, and killed, but not before restoring the true church and translating ancient records. This was the boy and man I love, the one I later sang about, who had ascended to heaven, where traitors and tyrants fight him in vain, where honored and blessed is his ever great name. But not everyone honors and blesses his name. There are many who consider him an enemy to God and Christianity, for many of the accounts of his vices are as compelling to them and evidence that he wasn't called of God as are the accounts of his virtues as compelling and convincing to others of his high and holy calling. His revelations are deep and authentic to some, but to others they are shallow and transparent fabrications. Can we make sense of the boy who wouldn't swallow a drop of alcohol to deaden the pain of the surgeon's knife, yet who apparently enjoyed a drink in later years? Who is this man who can translate without originals, who can hold an audience spellbound, whose followers unabashedly pay him tribute as the greatest prophet to ever live, but who others saw as deceptive, garrulous, lazy, and manipulative? What do we do with the man who convinced married women they would have a better chance at heaven if they gave themselves to him? The stories my grandmother told me over half a century ago were of a sweet boy. I think of him as Melville's Billy Budd, that handsome sailor whose virtue oozed out of him like fragrant cologne. Rank sailors were drawn to him like hornets to sugar, becoming his loyal friends, never able to do enough for Billy. But into that picture creeps another account that makes Joseph seem more like Elma Gantry than Billy Budd. Sinclair's Gantry was handsome and athletic. He was compelling when he preached, drawing people to the altar to confess and be saved. He did what he had to hide his ambitions, including the sexual, and where he couldn't hide them, he made them palatable to his followers. Now, over half a century later, I have to admit that there is more to Joseph than the stories grandmother told me. Joseph Smith is not unlike the proverb she often quoted to me, quote, "There is so much bad in the best of us and so much good in the worst of us that it doesn't behoove any of us to talk about the rest of us." We are, all of us, a mixture of good and bad. We hope the good outweighs the bad. We know we are wrong, inauthentic, when we try to paint ourselves as being all virtue and vice-free. Our deepest wish is for people to recognize our flaws, but to accept them as not seriously outweighing our good qualities. Even as we put our best foot forward, we know we have yet another foot. The stories my grandmother told were the official church version. In time, they were told certain ways to achieve certain purposes. In the process, Joseph has been stripped of his humanity and a portrait created with both brush and words, making him handsome beyond belief. A prophet would never allow himself to be idolized if he were a true prophet, nor would we want to idolize him. Appreciate, value, love, follow, yes. Idolize, no. Somewhere along the way, we have to realize he is one of us. Maybe he was one of the great ones, but nevertheless, one of us. Throughout history, there have been instances where the bearer of bad tidings was punished. There have been cases where he who brought good news was rewarded. The messenger and the message were connected. Even though in these modern times we try to distinguish between the message and the messenger, we aren't always successful, nor is it in every case possible. Nowhere is this more apparent than with Joseph Smith. The revelator is as important, or more so, than the revelation. The credibility of the revelation hinges on the perceived credibility of the revelator. Whether it will ever be possible to separate Joseph from his revelations is hard to say, but up until now, they, the revelations, and the revelator are as bound together as sinew and muscles. On the one hand, there are those who think if they protect his image, even to the point of excessive glorification, his message is validated. On the other hand, there are those who attempt to invalidate his message by demeaning the man. In either case, both groups are curiously in agreement of a basic underlying assumption. A flawed person cannot have true revelations. Thus, the messenger supersedes the message. Somehow it circles around to the source of the oracles, to God. The argument served to constrain God in whom he can choose as a revelator. It calls into question the entire process of revelation without shedding any light on the process. It simply argues that no good thing can come out of Galilee. So I ask myself, can I ever know Joseph? Has he been obscured beyond recognition? Both his devoted followers and his vocal opponents have played this puppet master to a Joseph of their own creation, giving him thoughts and motives that fit their image of him, of what they wish him to be. Late at night, I wonder about him, who he was, and I try to get inside him to know him, to see his world through his eyes. But my nighttime seeking reveals more of me than of Joseph. The vision I receive is not of Joseph, but of his influence on me. What I experience is my affection for the man whom I willingly call a prophet. Much that I hold sacred I trace to Joseph. My belief in the power of community and place are grounded in his teachings. My belief that the world, earth, is a living organism and that I am part of the living whole derives from him. My belief that I've always existed in some form, that I should govern myself, that I am entitled to joy, that I fare better if I don't aspire to the honors of men, secular or churchy, are from Joseph. My belief in an unseen world, mysteries, and the esoteric find their way back to Joseph. I find I can partition him from Brigham Young and the history of the church in the Great Basin. I can just let Joseph be a man who had encounters with the mysteries, visions, angels, spirits, dreams that wrapped around him like a shroud. He was one man at one time that could see things others couldn't, while promising them they could see too in time. We all have dreams. Dreams come to us in our sleep, and they come to us in our waking hours. Joseph's dreams were visions. Maybe their form was no different from what any of us experience, but Joseph understood them and penetrated the imagery, the symbolism, foreshadows, and past shadows, and wove them into descriptions of heavenly kingdoms and eternal beings. Mysteries were laid upon mysteries, lyrical and evocative, spellbinding and hypnotic. On a drive through the North Georgia mountains, I stopped at the old train depot at Tallulah Falls, Georgia. The little brick building sitting near the edge of the Tallulah Gorge has been converted into a consignment shop for the handicraft of the mountain folks. One of the rooms had dozens of quilts in a variety of colors and patterns. Each quilt had a little hand-printed card designating the quilter and the pattern. Those early Blue Ridge Mountain quilters didn't always follow a pattern, but driven by utility and the constraints of time, they would cut and sew together whatever scraps of material they had. Their goal was to have a warm covering for a cold night, and the cold night was upon them. I am something like those hard-pressed quilters. I pulled together scraps of material about Joseph Smith and stitched them together without a pattern. Some of the scraps aren't very pretty and are of rough material. Other little pieces come together seamlessly. They have beauty and symmetry. How long my patchwork quilt of Joseph will remain stitched together, I can't say. Whether it will be replaced by something else, I don't know. Of this part, I am sure. No matter how frayed and worn it becomes, it will never be completely discarded. But I have little interest in those quilts hanging in public places that feature not the original pattern, but a stylized version of Joseph. Finally, the words of the poet Rumi. Whenever you meet a genuine spiritual teacher, be gentle and polite and fair with them. Ask them questions and be eager for answers. Never condescend. Thank you.
The golden plates lay hidden deep in a mountainside until God found one faithful in whom he could confide.
I hadn't decided until just when I stood up here if I was actually going to try and stay in tune and sing that. I'm never very good about that in public. But there it is. Although the song appears to have dropped off the list of the top 10 primary songs, in my day it was right up there with Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam and Gifts at the Little Stream. It appealed to the desire in me to matter in God's plan, to be what was extraordinarily hoped for by God, who had obviously waited a long time to find one faithful in whom he could confide that the Book of Mormon was, that the plates were in the Hill Cumorah ready to be translated. The story of the boy, Joseph, seeking God, resulting in a remarkable experience more tangible than a burning in the heart or a quiet feeling was fascinating. It was compelling. If Joseph could ask and receive, then couldn't I? Couldn't we all? That he would dare to ask and dare to ask on, to act on what he believed he had received has always been a beacon for my own spiritual seeking. What Joseph Smith taught that Parker Blount has reviewed was also compelling. The things that we as members of the church have gained, a sense of our preexistence, a sense of our future, our possible deification, the fact that we are here for joy, that we can speak with God. Some people require that anyone professing to be a prophet must speak inerrantly for God. In my experience, true prophetic gifts are often found among those who speak errantly as well as prophetically. The tendency to push the edges of one's expertise and embellish our native failings of human beings, even prophets. Some people require a prophet should have the heavens objectively open at all times and speak with God as one person speaks with another. In my experience, prophets deal with limited means in their divine communications. Flashes of openness seem to come more frequently to those blessed with prophetic gifts, and the trajectories of those flashes seem to reach farther into the darkness. Some people might require a prophet have equally divine vision about all areas of life, that a prophet never be deceived by his fellow men or women, never purchase fraudulent documents, for example, be able to see if those that come to them are frauds, that a prophet never have mundane difficulties in the material or financial world, never have significant estrangements from family and neighbors, that he be clairvoyant or she telepathic about all things relevant to material success, give universally correct advice, advise about ventures infallibly. This is not my requirement of a prophet. Yesterday, Mary Beth Raines and I were in a radio show that talked about Joseph Smith. And a caller that called in compared Joseph Smith to, for example, Paramahansa Yogananda, suggesting that an exemplary life is an important aspect of someone to whom you look as a prophet. And that got me thinking just in these last few hours before today about about cataclysmic prophets seem to have cataclysmic lives. And those who don't have cataclysmic effects seem not to have the kind of cataclysmic life that goes along with that. That's not said very well, but I think you follow my idea. Some people require anyone professing to be a prophet to have a universally exemplary life, to live by our construct of integrity, that all parts fit together and make sense. That is not my requirement of a prophet as well. What is it about Joseph Smith that still resonates within me that he is a prophet? I cannot ignore the narrative of his spiritual manifestations that's in our standard works as well as others. They do not all fit together. They have mellowed, ripened, and changed with age. I'll say something about that in a moment. Second, I am interested in the 11 witnesses of the record from which the Book of Mormon was translated. Third, aspects of Joseph Smith's life suggest that he attempted to live according to revelations he believed he had received in ways that were not always easy. Fourth, his consistent practice of looking for God's response to his questions and concerns. And fifth, the sublime truths that he taught. My own mystical experiences do not seem to be so much different from some that Joseph reports, including those that I would look back on and say are not very sublime. The result of my sincere prayer regarding Joseph Smith when I was 12 years old resulted in a complete flooding of my whole being with a divine light and love that I directly believed was an answer to my prayer about a specific question that I had formulated. Did Joseph Smith actually see divine beings that I would recognize as my Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ? That was the specific question. And to be flooded with divine light and love in a way that was unmistakable, and that I could look at years later and still get the essence of that experience and find that that experience had expanded me to all people. It's difficult to put it into words, what an experience like that does. But it took me from one space in my life and moved me to another. One space as a Mormon girl against the world, growing up in Protestant Indianapolis. That was a very strong feeling. And suddenly integrating me into, yes, this experience happened to Joseph Smith, and guess what? The only way it matters is that now it connects you with everyone. Those are the only words I can imagine describing it. Took me to a new realm of being. I had to take Joseph Smith's experience seriously. And yet develop over the years as hearing what Joseph Smith was like more than I was taught in primary. All of the developments in understanding Joseph's story are significant. I never felt afraid at looking at careful approaches to understanding new things about Joseph Smith or the Book of Mormon, even when they showed me the story did not seem to be all it was cracked up to be. Psychologist Rollo May spoke of the importance of looking for the God beyond God, expanding our current understanding. It's important to look for the Joseph Smith beyond Joseph Smith. I believe in a God who enjoys our bringing rational and scientific methods to the table of belief. A God who sees our doubt, even in Joseph Smith, as a tool which can be used positively in the restructuring of immature beliefs. The most personally difficult aspect among many was the report of Joseph Smith's pursuit of other men's wives as spiritual spouses and deceiving their husbands about that. There are some subjects and issues that are beyond my ability to fully grasp. Although I've read some of Thomas Murphy, some of Michael Whiting, and know something about the difference between mitochondrial DNA and nuclear DNA, I could not hope to evaluate any conclusions drawn from the current studies. There's more, but I think I'll leave it at that. I must, as many college professors promised would be required through life, continue to hold the questions and paradoxes in my hand, refusing to come to a premature conclusion of one kind or another. Thank you.
Well, 30 of you here could probably be up here sharing some of your own thoughts on Joseph Smith. I mean, the 3 or 4 days of it. And some of it may sound, be very, you know, slow or, you know, well, I might even say, I'll say it about mine. It might even be boring to some of you because you've heard it before. And yet I think that the fact that we are willing to come together to listen to each other's story tells me that I'm in good company. To answer many of the questions about Joseph Smith, and especially the one that we were called on to be in the panel is, who is Joseph Smith to you? Who is Joseph to you? I guess I had to modify a lot of what I'd written because as I heard other people the last 3 days, I've had to remove myself from what some people have really striven, worked to get, and that is, you know, did Joseph know he was a prophet? I don't pretend to have read enough to know what was in his mind, and of course I have no revelation on that subject, so I can only speak for myself. Ultimately, the church is defined by people like me. The world perception of the prophet is defined by my viewpoint. I don't pretend to influence anyone in the world but my own 4 children, and even that's debatable. But I think how my viewpoint is bound and formed is relevant 2-3 days ago, Lori Matlick-Kipp began her presentation on tracking the sincere believer by talking about the Mormon box. As a non-Mormon researcher, she sits outside my box, and I am her subject. She has never experienced my conversion and loyalty to the man who communed with Jehovah. The interior walls of my box, only I see. The experiences that were often shared by other people that are in my box. My own siblings have shown me that I remember those things differently. Was I even there during some of these experiences? It's almost irrelevant. My recall is my reality. But on one of the walls of my box, I have a little mirror. It reminds me that if there were 4 cats in my box and each one sat at a corner, each could only see 3 cats. The walls of my box could be built of straw, and I come to Sunstone to see if there's more light available through some window. And I picked up a couple of things the last couple of days that have made me think much beyond. So the walls that were not constructed by me about who I am, really, I want to keep on expanding. Those walls, I guess, are not for me to change because I can't, but I can push against them to see and try to make sense. So anyway, some clarifications of that's not in my box of experience. I've never seen God. I've never seen Jesus, and I've never seen Joseph. So how can I speak on this subject? Well, that's when we come back to, faith. I speak by faith, not by knowledge. I do believe that those three, both Joseph, Jesus, and God, live. They existed. They exist. And they're in their own little boxes, too. Maybe big boxes. But I do know that I'm not, under the Brody's definition, he wasn't just a great man that deserves more recognition. He was beyond that. I do have some discomforts that rise up every time I sing Lord al Profeta, praise to the man, in whatever tune we do. And there are some words that every time that hymn comes make me very uneasy, and they are especially pointed in Spanish, where I sing them most often. But some of these words, hail to the man. Long shall his blood, which was shed by assassins, fleet unto heaven while earth lauds his fame. Earth must atone for the blood of that man, wake up the world for the conflict of justice. In Spanish, al gran profeta rindamos honores, por asesinos vertida su sangre por la justicia, a Dios clamará. Mundo alerta en la lid de la justicia, todo delito se debe pagar. The words in Spanish as they were translated are full of vengeance. The English one could be interpreted that way, but as I learned about Joseph and I sang this hymn, that blood, that earth that cries for revenge make me very uncomfortable. The last in Spanish, mundo alerta en la ley de justicia, todo delito se debe pagar. Wake up world. Because we're in justice, that crime must be paid for. The context of when it was written probably motivated people to get back at somebody. That makes me very uncomfortable because I don't see Joseph at that level. If Jesus were a 10, I would put Peter probably a 5. He backtracked a lot. We only have one evidence of 2, maybe. Paul might have been a 6. Elijah was cool. He must have been a great 7. But the others, I don't know how to rate. And I do know that I feel very uncomfortable celebrating Joseph's birthday. In December. Joseph? Jesus. I guess Joseph made more sense than Paul, at least for me. So he's got to be above Paul, but, you know, the cool power that Elijah had, okay, so maybe 7.1 for Joseph. Maybe a lot, but I can't put them in the same realm with Jesus. If they truly do exist, all three of them, then there's a wide difference. Of course, I'm approximating in this relative Jesus scale, but it's just the way I feel. Okay, so how do I resolve the common questions and factoids we learn about Joseph? For me, Joseph was a man. So was Muhammad. And with time, we romanticize and aggrandize people and events. Of Cortes coming into Tenochtitlan, we now view as the conquest of Mexico. 200 people showing up in a very great valley with a few tribes. None of them were kings. Of Columbus, we talk of the discovery of a new world. He showed up at some islands and they were really hungry. But we made it a big deal, and then we've toned it down. Of the Virgin appearing on a tree stump on 700 South, people talk of miracles. With time, the attributes multiply, I believe. Much of what we know of what defines a prophet is based on a few lines in a little compendium of a little book. But all the prophets we know very little of. In fact, most of it is hearsay. In others' beliefs, there is more fervor, and less information. You know, of Muhammad, we know some of his life. We know some of his relatives and a bit of his history, and then we know some dates. But that creates a lot of controversy and factions within their groups. But of Joseph, we know a lot. We keep on finding facts about him. But in fact, Joseph came in during the literate era. We should have a record of him. We have many people who met him. Other people that met Jesus, for example, we have very little record. You know, there's 2-3. There are many that are Joseph's descendants, and they have hardly had a fight about the birthright. But of course, we continue learning about that man. And I do say praise to his memory. He died as a martyr. That is my belief. And I have no trouble listening to Lance Owens in the last couple of days talk about the origin of the King Follett discourse and the influences from the East. I don't have any problem with seeing Quinn in the magical world. And I mean, those are constraints. Joseph had his box, a 19th century box, and yet ever and ever the keys he will hold. I did have, like Lisa, a hard time about the lying, especially about the wives. But then since when do men tell others about their wives? Joseph was fallible. He proclaimed it to be so. That his actions were not always consistent with action makes him more of a man. That's why I take points off him on the Jesus scale. Faithful and true, he will enter his kingdom, crowned in the midst of the prophets of old. Most of those prophets, most of us, if not all of us, know very little about. So if not the person, what of the products, the evidence? Of the Book of Mormon authorship, I spoke last year in a forum such as this, and my testimony of that hasn't changed. I still believe that Joseph wrote it, that it was inspired writing. It is certainly a product of the 19th century, and the linguistic side of me verified this much earlier than the DNA stuff. Productions, however, of the 19th century don't negate a prophet. How could anyone produce anything else? No other prophet has been able to do so. Nephi theoretically could have produced this whole thing in English, and we would not have even that translation need. He produced in what he could. the DNA evidence about native peoples is far behind the linguistic family and the paradoxes that it creates about people here. I am disappointed that I'm probably not Lamanite, because I do believe in the Book of Mormon, and it's pretty clear that they're going to get off Ephraim's shoulders, and they're going to kick some shoulders and get off from the impositions. But let me come back to the enhancements and benefits that I see as of Joseph being a prophet. And I'm going to only give one example of that. It lies in the 19th century production of some words that are actually also in Matthew 5:48. Actually 47, if you salute your brethren only, what do ye more? Do not even the publicans so? Then Jesus says, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Joseph's writing of that changes a little bit, and being a second language, I mean, English is a big thing to learn, but especially the modals, the may, could, shoulds are very tough to learn, and how you differentiate that. And now put that in the 19th century modals and see what happens. But if you look around and do a search for how Joseph did that in the Book of Mormon, it's very enlightening to me, because I've eventually in English have gotten to learn some of it. So instead of be ye therefore perfect, 3 Nephi, well, to cite the whole thing, says, old things are done away and all things have become new. This is also Jesus speaking. Therefore, I would that ye be perfect, even as I, or your Father who is in heaven, is perfect. I would that ye be perfect, instead of be ye therefore perfect. The imperative versus a complicated little group of I would that ye be. Those two models together is kind of like the might could that exists here in Utah that people say, they never say, I might could do that. But in fact, they might could do that a lot. So you have this, I would that ye be perfect. It only shows up in the writings of Joseph Smith, Book of Mormon, DNC, and another situations. That's a 19th century production, probably, because that's the only time we document it. We don't do that anymore. But we could. Be ye therefore perfect versus I would that ye be perfect. There's a willingness from Jesus in that phrase. It's not a command, because there's a big gap of what he could force us to do. But he says it, be ye therefore perfect? No. I would that ye be perfect. So I encourage you to look that one. Let me finish then with one more thought, because as I struggle to then justify my testimony, I said, I don't need to justify it. It's my box. It's what I believe, and you can't prove otherwise to me. My experiences are not yours. But I was reminded then to then look up Pilate, when he had Jesus in front of him, and he talks to Jesus, and he says, and you know, they're asking him to do away with him. And Pilate says, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee into me. What hast thou done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, and I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now is my kingdom not from hence. Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I unto this world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Pilate said unto him, what is truth? And then he did this, you know, whatever you want to phrase it. I feel like that. Am I a Mormon? Yes. Can I judge Joseph Smith? Can I judge others' writings of him? Probably not. I must say that it's my view of the world. It's how I conceive progress and the things that Joseph left for me. And I'm perfectly happy with it. I have found no better. And so I leave these thoughts with you.
I have a cousin who, when he was 2 or 3 years old, was taken to a portrait hanging in a meeting house and asked to identify who was in the portrait. And he said, Jesus Smith. And I don't even know who was in the portrait. And at one point, maybe it didn't matter that much, but I think it does now. I think that as a church, that it's pretty clear, I think, who's more important between those two individuals. And that's evolved not by de-emphasizing Joseph Smith, but by really bringing the Savior out to the prominent role in the last, I don't know, 20 years or whatever. I don't think there's much doubt left about that anymore, but not to say that Joseph Smith's position has been diminished at all. He's the central pivot point for my imagination in so many ways related to religious things. And my basic stance on Joseph Smith as an individual is, well, I grew up reading a lot of fantasy literature, playing Dungeons and Dragons. And so when I have heard things about some of Joseph's youthful involvements, folk magic, treasure digging, my internal response is, cool. The guy had an imagination. It was probably a good training ground for a future prophet to be involved with some of those things, and he grew out of them, and I see that as a really interesting and vital part of his identity, a positive thing in a lot of ways. So I've thought a lot about Joseph Smith, and I just want to touch on a few little key points that have been important in my imagination with regards to the prophet. That leg surgery story always kind of bothered me. And the reason it did is because if the alcoholic beverage that was available was the only anesthetic, I think he damn well should have drank it and taken it. I've always felt that way. I've thought he should have taken that. So that story always kind of has bothered me ever since I was young, I think. And I think it's been a story that's been spun probably different than it really was. But the next place where Joseph makes a big impact on my imagination is that when he experienced his first vision, the first part of that was an encounter with darkness, as we all know. And when I reached a point in my own life where spiritual things became real to me, my first, I use the word encounter loosely because I certainly didn't see or hear anything like Joseph did, but it was with some kind of a darker force. That was my first realization of spiritual things, and so I felt kind of a kinship with Joseph on a much, you know, different scale in my own case, but it made a lot of spiritual sense to me that when somebody's about to enter into a spiritual awakening, that the forces of darkness might try to prevent that. And that's something I've always related to with Joseph, and that has strengthened my belief in him as a prophet. It just makes a lot of sense to me that he would have experienced that kind of thing. When it comes to those different accounts of the first vision that we're troubled by, that apparently Joseph told different details at different times, I haven't personally come to terms with that, to tell you the truth. I haven't studied all of the different accounts or tried to make a definitive decision on that, but it does trouble me a little, I have to admit. In the end, though, I'm willing to reserve judgment on that and just assume that I don't have all of the factors. We don't know all of the factors involved. And So it's not something that's I think damaged my belief in the end result. Some of the other mistakes that we're aware of that Joseph may or may not have made, those to me are they really humanize him. And they make him into a complex and more interesting character who I think that we can all relate to better. There are a couple of those that I still haven't come to terms with. And I don't think they're going to fester and destroy my basic belief in Joseph Smith as a true prophet. I hope not. I know that can happen. But things like, if I remember correctly, at one point when he tried to touch the golden plates, he was shocked in some way and prevented from doing so. And that's a very humanizing moment for me. The story of when he persisted in giving the manuscript to Martin Harris and that whole fiasco that resulted. And I don't know, in Kirtland, I think the jury's still out on exactly what role Joseph played in all of those financial troubles and difficulties that went on there, but certainly he was faced with a huge, complex situation that I don't know that any of us could have done better, and I wonder sometimes why he didn't receive more help, but maybe that was part of his testing and in the growth of the church. And a similar thing happens with the Zion's camp, which we always hear, even though it seemed to fail on the surface in some ways, accomplished a lot of things in terms of showing who was loyal and faithful and developing future leaders. One of the stories of Joseph Smith that I've thought about the most was the situation where he put Heber C. Kimball through an Abrahamic test with Vilayet in terms of saying that Heber was asked to give Vilayet to Joseph as a wife. And the reason why that's stuck a lot in my imagination is because I happen to be a great-great-great-grandson of Heber and Vilayet. So if that encounter had gone differently at all, it would have had a big impact on me and my family. And I've often wondered, as a pre-existent spirit, were we aware of that situation, those descendants that would come later? And if so, did we already know in advance that it was an Abrahamic test, or were we wondering just as much what was going on as Heber and Vilayet were? And I'm not sure, I'm not sure to what degree Joseph was instructed to put them through that, or if it was some kind of a manifestation of what he felt he needed to do. That's another question that I wonder a lot about, and it's been part of trying to understand what we're being put through here in mortality. Probably the area where I have the most unresolved conflict personally with regards to Joseph is with some of the deception I understand took place in talking about his plural wives and those other issues related to that. And I'm quite unresolved on that and disappointed too. And I don't know, I'm willing to reserve judgment on it. But I don't know if it's one of those things like when Nephi was commanded to slay Laban, and it was a higher law overtook a lower law, or if it was something that maybe Joseph didn't handle the way he could have, but I can't think of any other way to have handled that situation. And again, that's another area where I'm willing to reserve judgment for now. I don't have to think that meant that he didn't have good character or enough good character to still remain a prophet, in my belief. And then, of course, his most fatal, and I would call it a mistake, was the way he handled the whole Nauvoo expositor thing, and I think that was a mistake, and it was a fatal mistake. I'm sure he would have been martyred at some point anyway, but I don't know if it had to happen at that time, and that's really thought provoking to wonder why he was allowed to make that mistake, if indeed it was a mistake, and that tension that has been talked about between, you know, when is a prophet receiving the inspiration, and when are they just acting on their own understanding and knowledge? And that's something that comes up so much with Joseph Smith. And as I think about him now from the perspective of today, you know, I wish the prophetic wealth had been spread a little more evenly over the intervening decades. I mean, I know that we needed to have the gospel restored and that Joseph Smith was the man to do that, but I would have liked to see a little more of a gradual drop-off in some of the exciting doctrines and theology and ordinances and everything. I mean, the Perpetual Education Fund is a wonderful thing. It's just not quite as interesting as what Joseph Smith was able to do as a prophet. And my hope is that one day that we'll again be led with a prophet, or led by a prophet, who's a lot more like Joseph Smith in terms of the, I call it the visionary imagination that he had. And I think that may happen. I think that we may, I'm certain that if Heavenly Father is, and the Lord are overseeing this whole operation, that the right people are put in place at the right time to be prophet. And I'm hoping that there's another personality down the line that's going to remind us more of Joseph Smith than some of the 20th century prophets have. I'm looking forward to that day, someone who may even bring forth those sealed portions of the Book of Mormon or do other things that are more like what Joseph Smith accomplished for us. I think that will happen someday, hopefully within my lifetime, or maybe I hope not, I don't know. But thank you.
My name is Randall Paul. I'm grateful to be here today and to participate. This has been a feast of learning already for me. What do I mean to say when I say Joseph Smith was a prophet? Hugh Brown, Latter-day Saint Apostle, moved me one Sunday evening in 1961 when I heard a recording of Profile of a Prophet, his classic comparative argument for the divine calling of Joseph Smith as a modern prophet of God. His strong voice impelled me to trust that Hugh Brown was no con man, but someone sharing what he believed about God, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit, and Joseph Smith. His words echo in me still. Quote, "I believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God because he talked like a prophet, he taught like a prophet, he lived and died like a prophet. As John the Beloved declared, the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. And if any man who ever lived had a testimony of Jesus and gave his life for that testimony and was effective in spreading the testimony and bringing convincing evidences of the truth of the statement that Jesus is the Christ among all the men that have lived, I challenge any man to show one who has given us more real evidences of the divine calling of Jesus Christ than did the prophet Joseph Smith. But undergirding and overarching all the rest, I say to you from the very center of my heart, I know that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. And all of these evidences and many others that could be cited may have the effect of giving me, in a sense, an intellectual conviction. But by the whisperings of the Holy Spirit, one may come to know. and by those whisperings I say, I do know. End quote. Via such voices and whisperings, including especially Joseph Smith's own account of the resurrected Moroni and John the Baptist and Jesus and others, I came to a conviction that Joseph Smith was a person who had broken through to communicate with others, who had overcome death and returned to hold out hope that the Christian good news was true. Joseph Smith's prophetic testimony led me to believe in one of the most important ideas of all, that after death there is a future life worth living with godlike men and women who will remember their mortal moments. A prophet is a person who breaks through the foggy veil to show us some eternal reality beyond our normal understanding. When I was young, I pondered Joseph Smith's experience that confirmed the possibility that humans could see and talk with literal resurrected persons. This seemed wonderfully outrageous and momentous to me, and I deeply desired that he had told the truth. Later in life, in the face of doubts about the existence of a loving God, Smith's 19th century testimony and those of his companions helped me believe most of the New Testament stories about Jesus' life and resurrection. I became convinced that any God worthy of worship must be one who loved and gave life like Jesus Christ. Indeed, just to believe in some kind of immortal God is a kind of prophetic breakthrough. I heard and desired and believed and became a prophet, like many of you, because of Joseph Smith's contaminating witness. Indeed, he was a prophet greater than Moses in the respect that he brought Moses vividly back to life and fulfilled Moses' wish that all Israel might become prophets. Joseph Smith was a greater prophet than most, according to the company he kept. I like the rating system. I'm going to have to think about that. The ancient disciples saw their master on the Mount of Transfiguration, where great ancient prophets honored him. When the events of the transfiguration of Jesus were repeated in formal ways during the early Restoration, Joseph Smith was initiated into that great prophetic tradition. And as the opener of the last dispensation, he was called to be the welder, the one who would put the whole world back together again before the finale. He, like Enoch, saw the beginning and the end, and understood God's loving purpose to organize his family in an environment where variety and beauty and joy could flourish through contrasting oppositions. I have spent some years studying religions and philosophies and great imaginative literature. No one's words or visions have moved me more than Joseph Smith's. The restored gospel is as edifying a religion as there is on this planet. It is, of course, weighted down with Mormons. But Joseph Smith complained about that to no avail. His own prophetic soul was weighed down by his human sins and weaknesses. He apparently lied about his multiple wives to either cover his sins or, benignly, to avoid more persecution for himself and his people. He was often angry and sometimes vengeful to those on his team who challenged his calling or behavior. However, he did not try to affect the personality of a prophet, nor even a saint. This, ironically, has always added to me credibility to his claims of divine interventions when they did occur. The heavenly muse was not always open to him, and he resented being left in suspense, feeling it a punishment since he knew from experience divine communion was available. Nevertheless, he taught that we are down here to work out our salvation without certainty, testing our mettle to the hilt. So he could say from experience that a person would gain more by looking into heaven for 5 minutes than reading all the books in the libraries. Yet, subsequently, he frequently spent days in studying secular matters and languages that might bring him more knowledge this side of the veil. He was a prophet who confirmed that great breakthroughs are yet to come. And try as we might, our puny arms cannot hold back the river of divine truth that is yet to pour down on saints in the latter days, be they inside or outside of the church. In sum, Joseph Smith, the prophet, revealed a new dazzling glimpse of the enormity of our loving God, and the abundant possibilities for all people in all times to expand their eternal lives.
One of the advantages of being the last panelist is that you discover everyone has already said pretty much what you were going to say. At least it seems to me we come from a similar complex view in all of us, and as I have listened to each of you, we've pretty much, as a majority, have had significant experiences either growing up or in our adulthood being outside of the Mormon cultural center of Utah or along the whole mountain states. And so I'm wondering if our personal stories are an important and crucial beginning about how we came to know Joseph and how we still look at him. So I'm starting with that premise, that how I came to know Joseph is a crucial piece of the complex lens that I've hopefully developed over time. I came to know Joseph really on the coast of Oregon in a small rural town, in a fishing and milling lumber town. And much like Parker, I had a grandmother, although she was not a Mormon from birth. She joined the Mormon church in her late 50s after belonging to many other Christian religions and exploring many Christian mystics, prophetesses, as well as prophets. And for her and for my father, her son, Jesus Christ was always the center of things, and Joseph Smith was an important prophet, and he brought the restored gospel, but that was just a piece of the puzzle in her mind. That was just a piece of puzzle in my father's mind. And over time, that's been for me also, in that Joseph Smith is a vehicle and an important vehicle for what I knew and came to believe throughout growing up Mormon and as a vehicle for knowing Jesus Christ, essentially. So in that viewpoint, that constructed lens, I've always been free, it seems to me, to take a step back or think about how I think about him different than maybe if I grew up here in the center of Mormon culture, or if there had been a different lens offered to me as a background. I'm going to add a couple other pieces that, over time, that have helped me construct ways that I see Joseph and what he currently means to me. I think beyond growing up in that small branch, I was also interested, as I grew into college days, in psychology and sociology, wanting to look at my own world and my own life, my own family. And I've also been interested in authentic, or what's the interior of spiritual experiences and how they speak to the outside. Even though Mormon culture, I think, has become over the years really framed around the exterior experience and the practical how-tos of how we live out a spiritual life in a community, the core of Joseph's experiences came from the inner mystical experiences. The core of my understanding about Christ and about God and about living life has come from my own inner spiritual experiences that came at a very young age, and my grandmother also, and my father, and they have shared those with me. So I've been interested in the interior path of things as much as I've been interested in the exterior path of things. So assuming that I fundamentally agree with pretty much everything everybody has said, let me explore that interior path in a couple of ways that have been important from my crafted lens. The first is that I've been very interested in what are interior, spiritual, or mystical experiences, and how do they play out in our lives. One of the reasons that I view Joseph as a prophet is that he had, he had genuine spiritual experiences that are really congruent with those experiences reported by mystics worldwide. There are many types of religious experiences, and in our scriptures we call them spiritual gifts, and it actually is a fairly good taxonomy. There may be others beyond that, and they're described in different traditions, in different labels, in different words, but integrative thinkers such as Ken Wilber that we discussed yesterday on a panel and others have brought together in the last century the interior experiences and the mystical traditions of all the major religions within the world, and have also sorted them out in a schema according to not just types of experiences, but also according to the developmental stages. They've also been at work through this last century of, you know, dozens of people on what we know in our interior states of consciousness from the very beginning of life, through the ultimate reaches of expanded and depth experiences. And one of the reasons that I see Joseph as a prophet is that he experienced all of those. He may have experienced a bulk of some different developmental stage, and he may experience them at another. So let me give you a couple of examples. The visions he experienced of God and Jesus Christ, whether he first saw them as or felt them as presences or interior experiences and later saw them in more anthropomorphic style, isn't as much of a concern to me, really, in that he experienced that at one of the highest transcendent stages that we know about, to have a deity mysticism. A deity have a personal relationship, not just an idea about, but he had a direct experience. And it's that experience in these transcendent stages in which one knows oneself not to just know God, but one is at the beginning place of knowing oneself as God. And not in a self-ego-identified state that I am God and I'm going to get to do this and I have this privileges of being married to these many people and being able to live in a certain sort of place on the golden streets of celestial kingdom. Not in that self-identity way, but in an expanded way of that we are in the all of it and we are in the all of it together. And I know God and I am God in the way that I know that you are also, and there's an expression among all of us. And we develop that and show that in a radiant way over time as we develop those characteristics. Or another way in Mormon consciousness is as we become more Christ-like, as we develop the consciousness within it, and it radiates and expresses itself outward, not from entirely what we profess or how it lines up with our life, although eventually I think it should, but how we are in our essence of being and how we attain that on a day-to-day basis. So that's just one type of experience he had. When he may have put somebody to an Abrahamic test, as was mentioned, and that is a difficult problem, he may indeed have had a spiritual experience. However, that may have been at a younger developmental stage, at a more egocentric stage, in which he wanted to prove something from him, and for himself, as well as he thought he received from God. So as I've studied these inner mystical experiences, it is an incredibly difficult thing to discern between your own inner wishes and needs, because they are so compelling, and the spiritual experiences that really come from beyond the self or from a more expanded state of ourself. So I think people actually have what they identify as spiritual experiences oftentimes comes from what their most unmet need is at the moment. And so they will interpret it in a larger light if it feels that, because in fact, our unmet needs have a huge intensity, and we often mistake that intensity with the ultimate reality. And as someone comes to discern more clearly what are, more, I think, more deep and expanded spiritual experiences, you start to understand sort of what feels like hunger, what feels like power, what feels like sex, what feels like spirituality and sexuality together, but isn't in a regressed wanting to own the object, wanting to own the self, but an expressive state. So there was a text I read years ago, one fairly advanced mystic, and he asked, as he came to know more and more and had more advanced states of consciousness, what was the real truth? And he said, I think more and more I know the real truth is that we have an infinite ability to fool ourselves. So for me, I've gradually developed this guideline, which is the more real the spiritual experience, not just how I receive it through my transmission system, but then how I interpret it. One guideline I use, and I'll then apply this back to Joseph, one guideline I use is how many people does this message benefit? And if it only benefits me, really, or only my little tribe, and not other people beyond myself, including this world, beyond the world, and possible all future worlds of wherever that may be, then it's a more limited view. So how wide is that expanse? So let's go back to Joseph for the moment. How is his message, or is his inner experiences that he experienced in that depth and range, not just in terms of developmental stages, but also in terms of the breadth of kinds of experience, so he had both. How much did that evidence itself throughout his life? And I would say it's very scattered. That he ranged from deep, authentic, expansive views, in that he created, he has in his writings and speaking of his experiences, he evidences as much insight and breadth as most wisdom traditions throughout the world. And then there are times when, you know, he receives a revelation that he's to do something and is to manifest himself. So that's scattered. That's a more younger state, should we say, or some people would say regressed state. So that one of the things that I think Ken Wilber, who is one of these integrative thinkers, says, is that we all have capabilities of receiving authentic spiritual experiences of all types all the time. The question really is where is our center of gravity in development? And then we will interpret those experiences through that lens. And that's what I would say fundamentally is how I put Joseph together. So let me, for the moment, pick up my mental health or my psychologically trained or my therapeutic diagnostic lens and look at it from yet another angle. We all have these lenses in which we view the messages. And I would say we also have many parts of ourselves and many needs co-running at one time. You can be sitting here, for instance, and thinking about how you're hungry and how you want to be intellectually stimulated and how you may want to be stimulated in other ways and how you might want to, get that money all squared up about something. All this can be running at the same time. And you can be happy and you can be sad and you can be very bored and you can see that we all have this little community of sub-selves running around in us. Well, and that really what happens is there an integrative consciousness that keeps us sort of in sort of one place, and at what developmental stage is that center of gravity, so to speak? So the really question is all of these various functions and parts of ourselves kind of working on the same committee? Or are there various different rooms that are compartmentalized from others? And I would say that probably Joseph, as much as any prophet, and I liked your cataclysmic prophets have cataclysmic lives, that his center of gravity actually moved up and down and around from time to time. The calmer things were and the more support he had, and the more support he felt internally from the Lord, then it sort of came together and worked better. But at times when things were more fractured and there was more trauma and he was sitting in Liberty Jail, that comes apart a bit. We all regress under stress. So the central question, was he a picture of mental health or was he emotionally off balance? That's sort of the diagnostic question I might ask for the moment. And I would say it depends. On a continuum, he functioned at times way beyond the usual range and capacity of normal functioning. At other times, he could tie it down to the ground and construct a regular life and really deliver a message that other people also could live a regular life, an expanded life. In fact, I think one of his expanded views, and it's true of most wisdom traditions, and he really brought it to the fore, is that everybody claimed their own revelation, their own inspiration, and wanted to work that out in a community. On the other hand, he was severely dislocated at times and showed difficulties in kind of matching up the outside world and the inside world. Was he depressed? I think he was probably severely depressed. Did he show signs of severe trauma and reactions to advanced trauma? Absolutely. And I'm going to bring up two other issues that people have brought up about Joseph that none of the other panelists have, and that is, did he actually have some mental disorders such as schizophrenia or bipolar, or was he a sociopath? I don't know. We are using present-day diagnostic lens, you know, back 150 years or so. But I would say that if we were to use that lens just for fun, just like you're using a prophetic rating scale, the relative Jesus scale, which I like. What was his relative mental health scale? It's entirely possible he may have some form of bipolar disorder, although I wouldn't guess it's what we now think of as that. There's another diagnostic category called bipolar 2, which is much milder. It doesn't take people into sort of the craziness of off-the-chart psychoses, and nor does it take you down to the depths in a way. Even though he speaks of depths and highs, it doesn't seem to evidence in his life. Well, Joseph's life is much more put together than somebody who really has long-running bipolar. It turns out also that the big question about was he psychotic, did he have psychoses, it's a very interesting inquiry, which we don't have time for today, about when somebody is psychotic, how is that different than when you have a spiritual experience? You know, we could go into a lot of it and have a whole panel about that, but let me just tell you my clue, and that is, if somebody is psychotic, most of the time, the message is regressive. It's about oneself. One is so important, inflated, being Christ or being someone, or one is so special that everybody's out to get them. And it will be a deeply disturbing experience or a dislocated experience that nobody else could sign up for. Or is the message, is it expansive beyond the self, and that other people could have benefited, not only as equally as you, but people could benefit it maybe more than you. You're willing to take a second position. You're willing to not stand in the middle, for instance. And I think he was able to do that. So I don't think he was psychotic. That doesn't ring true for me. Was he a sociopath? There, some people would say, well, he was such a charmer, and he could hide things, and he could use people, and a lot of things that may add up as little traits. But the core of whether somebody is sociopathic or not is, do they have deep compassion? Can they put themselves in the place of the other? Will they at times step aside and work for the other's benefit more than their own? And I would say, using those criteria, he was not a sociopath. He was severely dislocated, had not pulled all these sub-selves together, working on the same committee all the same time. That's what I'd say. But the crucial question as it comes to is that I've kind of used all these lens is, do I think Joseph was a prophet? And I believe Joseph was a prophet as prophets are prophets, that they lead foibled lives, that they are everyday people. And I'm in concurrence with the rest of the panelists about that, and that we can still have transcendent experiences. And so let me use the therapy card for just a moment and ask a number of questions. Let's turn it back on ourselves, not just on me, but on all of us. As I said before, your belief in Joseph is an accumulation of your experiences and your interpretation of your own experiences throughout your life. For example, as you grew up, was Jesus Christ or Joseph Smith more important in your central understanding of the gospel? And if so, how do you see that? Do you see Joseph Smith as perfect? Does he have to be seen as perfect? And do you and your family expect perfect in order to lead a good life? For instance, when you face the inevitable disillusionment or disappointment in perfectionism, what do you do with it? That helps piece together how you know Joseph Smith and how you picture him together. As it turns out, disillusionment and growing beyond it by picking up the pieces and putting in new ones are as crucial to spiritual maturity as constructing our original beliefs in the first place. Hebe Brown said that serving, if you want to count yourself as a servant of faith, you must serve a stewardship of doubt. So from my sense, I've had a constructed, deconstructed, and now reconstructing faith, both in the gospel and in Joseph Smith. And I would then ask you, along with myself, to ask maybe using other criteria. Do you use several criteria in judging Joseph as a prophet? Do you use either or? He did this or did not? Was the message or the messenger more important, as Parker said? But use other criteria possible. Do you use wisdom? What do you ask? What was the wisdom in his messages and spiritual practices beyond the life of the man? Can you, in your own life, judge the truth in your life as different from the source of truth? Do you have inner experiences and expanded awareness at time that you really come into you and you know to be true, or you know to be expansive, or it resonates as meaning in your life, and yet you don't follow through with that, or you don't pull it together really well from time to time? And how do you judge yourself regarding that? My last statement about that is, how do you judge heroes in your life? When they come apart, much as I think it was Chris talked about in terms of fantasy life and Dungeons and Dragons and heroes and so on. Heroes in fantasy life is a necessary part of growing up. But when those heroes fall apart in a perfect state, what do you do with it? What about your personal heroes right now beyond Joseph Smith? Do you require the current general authorities of the church, for instance, to lead unfoibled lives? What do you take of yourself when somebody calls you a hero, and you surely have been at various times, and yet you know that you have these imperfect foible selves? Do you keep them secret? Do you lie about them? Do you not tell the truth in all things? I think we all live together the same question of Joseph Smith as a prophet and his foibled, fractured, put-together, wonderful life in the same way that we sit in our own fractured, foibled, perfect, wonderful lives. Thank you.